Welcome back to your listeners. It's wonderful to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Dear friends, we live in this fast-paced world, and in this fast-paced world, we just seem to be running around from day until night, morning until evening, really without any breaks in between. It is interesting, but Islam as a religion has emphasized highly that we should take time out in our daily life every single day and pay attention and focus to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And so in what form does Islam help us and teach us to focus on Allah? Well, it's through primarily the five daily prayers. These wajib, obligatory prayers which a Muslim prays five times a day. Now, when talking about Imam Ali alayhi salam, we find that he was completely detached from the world, and he was so absorbed in Allah that he did not feel any pain because he was so absorbed and focused towards Allah. Now, of course, this doesn't mean that he was immune to pain, but it means that despite feeling pain, he would be so absorbed and focused in Allah that it was this focus and this attention and this love and this connection with Allah which was more powerful than the pain that he was feeling. Of course, I'm sure that many of you have heard about the story where once Imam Ali was hit with an arrow in his leg in one of these battles, and nobody was able to pull out this arrow out of his leg because there was so much pain involved in taking this arrow out, right? The arrow had penetrated so deep inside Imam Ali's leg that they knew that if they pulled it out, it would cause an incredible amount of pain. And so we find that the people then decided that when Imam Ali was to be in his prayers, that is when they would pull out this arrow. And this is because the people even knew that only in prayer is it that Imam Ali's spirit takes a distance, detaches from his body, in which he will not feel pain, because in prayers his attention and his focus will be towards Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. And so, dear friends, just an example of how one should have complete focus in their prayers, despite the trials and tribulations that we face in our lives. A very profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم إني أسألك الأمان يوم لا ينفع مال ولا بنون إلا من أتى الله بقلب سليم.
O Allah, I ask you for the protection on the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil.
وأسألك الأمان يوم يعض الظالم على يدي يقول يا ليتني اتخذت مع الرسول سبيلا.
And I ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger.
وأسألك الأمان يوم يعرف المجرمون بسيماهم فيؤخذ بالنواصي.
And I ask you for protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks, so they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet. And I ask you for protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child give any satisfaction for his father. Surely the promise of Allah is true.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Even when Amir al-Mu'mineen goes into the Masjid al-Kufa, he knew Ibn Muljim was there with the sword. What are his intentions? But he couldn't do anything. Because you cannot punish a person because of the intention, especially if your knowledge is based on, you know, ilm al-ghayb and not your normal means of information. And this is where we see that the musibat of Amir al-Mu'mineen, that when he goes into the sajda, all of us go into sajda, and when we get up, normally we get up with a kind of a speed getting up. And you can imagine, as soon as Amir al-Mu'mineen was there in the sajda, and when he says, Subhana Rabbi al-A'la wa bihamdi, and after doing the zikr when he is getting up, Ibn Muljim was waiting for that moment. As soon as Amir al-Mu'mineen goes into sajda, he took out the sword, he comes to the mihrab closer to Amir al-Mu'mineen and striked it. He just struck the head of Amir al-Mu'mineen in such a way that when the person who was the doctor of the city came to, you know, check Amir al-Mu'mineen, he basically said that the sword had penetrated all the way to the brain. And the poison which was there in the sword had gone into the mouth. And so there is no cure for that. You know, when we hear about it, even then, look at the sense of justice and adl of Amir al-Mu'mineen. He indeed is the embodiment of justice and fairness.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now. with reporters.
Another wide-scale operation was launched by the Yemeni army against the oil giant Aramco in several areas in Saudi Arabia. The spokesman of the Yemeni army said Yemen's air force has successfully targeted Aramco's oil facilities in Ras Tanura in Dammam with 8 drones of Samad 3 type and a ballistic missile.
Our forces have targeted Aramco oil facilities in Ras Tanura in the Dammam region, eastern Saudi Arabia, with 8 Samad 3 drones and a Zulfiqar ballistic missile.
Saria also added that Aramco's facilities in Jeddah, Jazan and Najran were also successfully hit by 5 ballistic missiles and 2 drones of Samad 3 type. He then warned Riyadh against further attacks until the war on Yemen is stopped. Earlier, Saudi officials said they had intercepted ballistic missiles targeting eastern province as well as the cities of Najran and Jazan in the south. The attacks came in response to the years-long Saudi aggression against Yemen.
Yemen's army has no way but to intensify its attacks against Saudi Arabia amid the kingdom's aggression against the impoverished nation. Saudi Arabia uses all capabilities, targeting civilian areas in Yemen, destroying the country's infrastructures. The latest attacks by the Yemeni army serve as a tit-for-tat operation.
Saudi Arabia launched a deadly war against Yemen in March 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children, and displacing millions more.
People here hailed the Yemeni army for its retaliatory attacks on Saudi Arabia. They say Saudi Arabia will remain a legitimate target for them as long as it continues its aggression against the impoverished nation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Across the world, the Afghan crisis continues to be a major talking point. It's no different here in the EU's de facto capital, Brussels. Members of the public have been sharing their views with Press TV.
I think we should leave the country and try for themselves to come out of it.
We should not intervene sometimes in proposing democracy or the sorts of political situations where they're not in, when the country is not ready.
Especially the United States. Did in this country, it make it worse, I think.
Now they are taking all of the materials, but I think as a global community we should interfere, but to stop that.
Power and interference always go together.
Anti-war campaigners are furious at remarks made by EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell last Thursday. He said Afghanistan proves the need for an expanded EU military force, more commonly referred to as the EU Army.
We have to step up our integrated approach, combining military, civilian, development and diplomatic efforts.
We have been speaking to citizens about Afghans who are desperate to seek asylum. EU leaders, they don't want more refugees. Do you think we should take more refugees in?
Yes, he needs. He needs to take more refugees because these people is in bad situation in their country.
Belgian people or European people say that we don't have enough place, but I think we have.
We must take refugees because all the people are on the same world. We are the same world.
They need to offer that help, and I believe that they need to offer a place to stay because they have nowhere else to stay.
The policy of occupying nations against their will certainly didn't go well in Afghanistan. Top EU officials and also prime ministers in the 27-country bloc are saying lessons must be learned. A good start, critics argue, would be for the EU to stop responding how high when Washington shouts, jump. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Among the 7 Iranian COVID vaccines, Covpars is making a name for itself. Developed by Razi Serum and Vaccine Research Institute, the recombinant vaccine started the third human trial phase on Sunday.
In this phase, we are going to have 40,000 people in 2 groups, one receiving Sinopharm and the other Razi Covpars. we are going to compare the number of people who are going to get sick in each group, and by comparing with each other, what we are hoping to show is that the efficacy of our vaccine is at least the same as the Sinopharm.
Iran has so far vaccinated roughly 10% of its population. This as the resurgence of the coronavirus in more lethal forms, like the Delta variant, has been killing an average of around 500 Iranians every day in the past month. As the government is scrambling to import more vaccines, Kovpars authorities say they're working to get an emergency use license to help speed up the inoculation program.
Given the restrictions imposed by U.S. sanctions on the way of vaccine imports to Iran, we need to boost our domestic production of COVID vaccines. So we are expecting that Kovpars will get the emergency use license halfway through the third trial stage.
Kovpars is administered in three doses, two intramuscular shots 21 days apart, and one intranasal shot 1 month after the second dose. Kovpars says if all goes based on the plan, the vaccine will hit the market in 6 months.
As the coronavirus keeps transforming into wilder variants, Kovpars developers say they've already launched their production line to speed up the vaccination process. The biotech firm says as soon as it gets the emergency use license, it will kick off mass production with a capacity of 3 million doses per month. Yusuf Jalali, Alborz Province.
Taliban have deployed more troops and military hardware to the northeastern Panjshir Valley to take the last remaining territory in Afghanistan from the National Resistance Front, headed by Ahmed Massoud, the son of Afghanistan's national hero, Ahmad Shah Massoud. Massoud has called for a negotiated settlement with the Taliban, but has said his forces will resist if the narrow and mountainous valley is attacked. Meanwhile, some top political leaders urge both sides to set aside differences and resume a meaningful negotiation in a bid to avoid dangerous scenarios, mainly the loss of civilian lives in Panjshir, as well as a spread of armed resistance across the rest of provinces.
The only way of the ongoing situation in Panjshir is to simultaneously resume meaningful negotiations and continue resistance against any totalitarian policy to pave the way for establishment of an inclusive government.
This is while the expansion of war has forced hundreds of local villagers to flee their houses. They call on the international community and especially the UN to convince both sides to resume negotiations.
The war has forced us to flee our village and come to Kabul. I have 5 children. We have nowhere to go but city parks. We want peace. Our children should take up their education in a calm atmosphere. So I want Massoud and Taliban to stop their war machines.
The possible fall of Panjshir Valley into the hands of Taliban will bring the entire country under the rule of Taliban for the first time, as they couldn't capture Panjshir Valley during their first rule in Afghanistan before their collapse in 2001. The war on Panjshir has turned into a big headache for the Taliban. Moreover, the group's leaders have so far failed to reach an agreement on the formation of the new government in Kabul. The Taliban have postponed the move again, saying they need more time for final consultations among the group's top leaders. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
A high-level Lebanese ministerial and security delegation has arrived in Damascus. Deputy Prime Minister of the Lebanese caretaker government, Zain Akkar, who holds several other positions, headed the delegation, which included the Ministers of Energy and Finance, as well as head of the General Directorate of General Security. They were welcomed by Syria's Foreign Minister at the Jdeidet Yabus crossing. The delegation held talks with several Syrian officials at once at the Foreign Ministry, namely the Syrian Ministers of Foreign Affairs, Finance and Oil. Talks focused on economic cooperation and Lebanon's need of Syria's help in transferring gas for generating electricity.
The two sides discussed the difficult circumstances they are living in, especially the electricity and gas sectors. The Lebanese side asked Syria to help Lebanon in transferring Egyptian gas and Jordanian electricity through Syrian territories. The Syrian side welcomed our request and expressed Syria's readiness to assist.
Both sides agreed to follow up the technical aspects and details of implementation through a joint technical team. Observers believe such a visit was only possible due to the U.S. backing of a plan that ensures Lebanon obtains gas.
I think Lebanon got a green light from the U.S. for such a visit. The Syrian government conveyed a message to the Lebanese side that it has accepted their request. I think the matter now is in the hands of Lebanon to get a regional and international approval for Syria's participation in pumping gas to Lebanon, as there are U.S. and EU economic sanctions on Syria.
Lebanon is seeking to revive a 2009 deal which stipulated that Egypt transfers millions of cubic meters of gas annually to Syria through Jordan, while Syria pumps the same amount to Lebanon. This is Lebanese officials' most significant visit to Syria since the start of the crisis in 2011. Lebanon, which remained relatively neutral towards Syria for so long, seems to have no other option now in light of its economic slowdown but to fully reactivate its cooperation and relations with Syria in hopes of some economic relief. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Streets remain deserted and business establishments closed in all major towns and the capital city of Indian-administered Kashmir for the second day after the death of the region's veteran separatist leader, Syed Ali Gilani. Indian forces continued a strong presence to prevent anti-government protests and enforce a strict lockdown. The authorities had also imposed near total communication blockade across Kashmir as a precautionary measure to maintain law and order. On Friday, additional deployments were made to prevent people from holding anti-government protests after the Friday prayers.
Gilani, the most powerful separatist leader in Kashmir who spent many years in different jails, died on Wednesday evening at his Srinagar residence, where he had remained incarcerated for the past decade.
As the news of his death spread far and wide, authorities swung into action and sealed the roads leading to Gilani's Hyderpura residence. Security was beefed up across the region, barricades erected, and key roads sealed, calling and internet services were shut. According to his family members, the former lawmaker, who after quitting electoral politics in late 1980s had for years spearheaded the separatist movement in Kashmir, had desired to be buried in Srinagar's historic martyrs graveyard, but the family members alleged that police forcibly took away his body and in a quiet funeral buried him in a graveyard near his residence.
He passed away late evening. We live in his neighborhood. We were neither allowed to visit his residence to pay him last respect, not allowed to participate in his funeral sitting COVID. This is very unfortunate. It will hurt us forever. We wanted to participate in the funeral procession of our leader, but we were not allowed by forces. He was hurriedly buried, and no one was allowed to say him the final goodbye. At least we should have been allowed to offer funeral prayers.
Known for his pro-Pakistan stance, Gilani led several anti-India protests and marches. He became a household name during 2008 and 2010 public uprising in Kashmir. A staunch advocate of Kashmir's right to self-determination, Gilani had stepped down as Hurriyat Conference chairman after he suffered with ailing health. He was conferred Pakistan's highest civilian honor in 2020. His death has been widely condoled, with Pakistan's Premier Imran Khan describing him as, quote, Mujahid Kashmir. Meanwhile, police spokesman has said that there has been no incident of violence or protest in Kashmir after Gilani's death. Kashmir has been a bone of contention between India and Pakistan. Both the nations claim the region in full, but rule it in parts. Sidri Safib, Indian-administered Kashmir.
A new major victory has been achieved by the Yemeni army against the Saudi-backed forces in Yemen's oil-rich province of Marib. Yemen's armed forces have recaptured the strategic Rahab district and the southern Marib, meaning that all supply routes linking Al-Bayda and Marib will be cut off from the Saudi-backed forces.
Cutting off the supplies in Al-Rahba would weaken the enemy forces. There is also synchronization in the movement of our forces in the rest of the northern and southern fronts towards the city of Marib, and this constitutes a siege on the city from all sides. All supplies have been cut off from the Saudi-led forces, and they can no longer carry out any military action. Light weapons will be more effective, and the army is now able to advance more towards Harib and Al-Juba.
The Yemeni army has also managed to take control of other military sites overlooking the city of Marib from the western and northern sites, which would help the armed forces continue advancing towards the Harib and Al-Juba areas.
The Yemeni army managed to liberate the entire district of Al-Rahba and cut off the supply routes from Al-Baida. With that, the liberation of Al-Juba and Habri area became easier for the Yemeni army. There is an insistence by the Yemeni army to liberate the city of Ma'arib, especially after the Saudi-led coalition's rejection of Ansarullah's recent initiative to stop military operations there.
For months now, the Yemeni army has been intensifying its military operations aimed at liberating the strategic Ma'arib province from the Saudi-backed forces, including terrorist groups. Ma'arib has strategic importance as an oil-rich province. It is the last stronghold of Saudi Arabia in northern Yemen. Yemenis believe that the army will eventually liberate Ma'arib from all foreign powers, including the Saudi-backed forces. They say now Riyadh has to bear the consequences of its disregard for Ansarullah's recent initiative to end the ongoing crisis in Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washari, Sana'a.
Overnight security clampdown and communications blackout occurred in Indian-administered Kashmir after the region's iconic leader, Syed Ali Shah Gilani, died. The mosques in the region announced the demise. However, Gilani's followers were not able to participate in his funeral prayers.
Every home in Kashmir is mourning this loss. Authorities do not allow anyone to move out of homes. They should not have done this. It was our right to participate in his funeral prayers. After all, India claims to be a democracy. Can't we even mourn?
Officials say people's participation could have resulted in massive law and order problems.
Restrictions were imposed to keep law and order in place. No untoward incident occurred anywhere during the last 24 hours, and the situation has been peaceful.
Kashmir has witnessed a record number of internet blackouts in the world and is the world's largest militarized zone. Analysts say people of Kashmir have been forced into this silence since India stripped Kashmir of its autonomous status in August 2019.
The silence which was imposed upon the people is a human rights violation. They could not go to attend the funeral of their one of the veteran tallest leaders of Jammu and Kashmir, who has all along his life said and advocated about the right to self-determination.
The Organization of Islamic Cooperation has condemned the Indian government's denial of right to choose burial rituals inside of Syed Ali Shah Gilani. Observers say people of Kashmir have been forced into a controlled kind of a life where every rule is not set by their choice, but by the force of the governing authorities.
Syed Ali Gilani was one of the tallest leaders of the resistance movement of Jammu and Kashmir and was advocating for right to self-determination. He deserved a respectful funeral, but the government did not allow the funeral to happen other than his family members. International covenants and international law says that every person who dies is to be handed over to his family for a choicest burial and a choicest funeral.
People of Kashmir say since the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party took a unanimous decision on Kashmir's special status in August 2019, a lot has changed without their consent. They say the silence of international community on the plight of Kashmiri people has added to their miseries, and with each passing day, living in the controlled land is getting difficult for them. And sooner or later, Kashmiri people are going to be the world's new asylum seekers. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
A house was recently bombed by a U.S. drone strike. Shrapnels have even damaged the door of the house. 10 members of a single family, including 6 children, lost their lives in the recent U.S. drone strike. As the relatives of the victims say, the owner of the house, which was targeted by the attack, was an engineer with no ties to any terrorist group. Imal Ahmadi is the brother of the owner of the house. He explains how the USA strike claimed the lives of his beloved ones in a moment.
I had left the house almost 10 minutes before that U.S. brutal attack. I quickly got back after I received a call from a relative. I saw the dead bodies of my brother, his sons and daughters all over the yard.
Blaming the U.S. for launching blind attacks on civilian areas, Amal is also angry on international journalists and the United Nations for what he says turning a blind eye on their misery.
A number of local and international journalists have so far interviewed us, but no one, including the United Nations, has heard our voice. Everybody follows his or her own agenda with paying no attention to our demand. We want justice, and the UN is responsible.
It was August 30 when the US airstrike hit this vehicle inside a house located in northeastern Kabul. Later, Pentagon said that they have successfully eliminated a vehicle packed with explosives in the city of Kabul. However, Taliban urgently condemned the attack, calling it an inhuman assault on civilians. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Turkey has proposed to the European Union a substantial migrant deal. Turkish foreign minister said in a joint presser with Dutch foreign minister Sigrid Kaag that this time Turkey will not handle the burden of refugees alone and will need a new deal with the EU, unlike the previous one, where the bloc would only pay a certain amount of money and leave Turkey to handle the rest.
On the issue of the Afghan migrants, there will be no such cooperation if the EU's approach would be based on we give money and you keep them there. We have fulfilled our responsibility. The number of migrants trying to go to Europe has decreased 95%, but the EU did not do its part.
Following the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan, Turkey tightened its security measures at the borders to prevent the wave of Afghan refugee influx to the country. Previously, the Turkish president said, his country has no duty, obligation, or even responsibility to be Europe's refugee warehouse, assuring that international cooperation is needed to prevent a new migration wave from Afghanistan.
There is an urgent need for a new deal for sure. However, this time the deal will be different than the previous one due to the changes that took place worldwide. Not only is it up to EU and Turkey, but also the United States is involved in the issue of Afghan refugees. Turkey now has closed its borders in front of refugees, not only because a deal is not reached yet, but the burden of refugees is actually affecting the AKP internally as well. People have started to feel the burden of migrants and the country and are now pressuring the government to stop receiving them.
The AKP is under pressure from opposition groups and citizens who are calling for a solution for the increasing number of refugees and foreigners residing in the country, which most likely will affect votes in the upcoming elections. Turkish citizens are complaining from unemployment, high demand on real estate, and other problems caused by the fact that Turkey has become a safe haven to those fleeing crisis-hit countries. The Turkish government now has to make a balance between fulfilling the needs of the EU and international community and surrendering to its own people's demand of sending the already existing refugees back. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
At least 200 children in Florida missed school last week because they were lying in hospital beds sick with COVID-19. Even as overall cases in Florida decrease after a record spike, the state recorded more new coronavirus cases in August than at any other part of the pandemic. Hospitalizations among children have increased. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist Greg Graziosi, writing for The Independent. The piece is titled, Texas and Florida See Rise in Child Hospitalizations Due to Coronavirus as Battles Over Student Masking Continue. least 200 children in Florida missed school last week because they were lying in hospital beds sick with COVID-19. Even as overall cases in Florida decreased after a record spike, the state recorded more new coronavirus cases in August than at any other part of the pandemic. Hospitalizations among children have increased. Data from the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, suggests a 5.5% increase in hospitalizations for people 17 years old and younger in the state of Florida over the past week. Students in Texas are not faring much better. The state has one of the highest COVID-19 mortality rates in the country for people under the age of 18, with 59 children dead. In the last several weeks, the state of Texas has recorded more than 50,000 coronavirus cases in students. Despite the state's Republican legislature's recent passage of an extremely restrictive abortion ban, ostensibly for the purpose of saving the lives of the unborn, its lawmakers have taken steps that have actively put children at risk. Texas's Republican Governor Greg Abbott, like Florida's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis, used his executive power to ban school districts from enforcing mask mandates for students. The executive order flies in the face of recommendations from both the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, and the American Academy of Pediatrics, which both recommend that all school students, staff, and teachers wear face masks during school to help prevent the spread of the specially transmissible Delta variant of the coronavirus. A judge in Florida ruled that Governor Ron DeSantis's executive order was unconstitutional. Nevertheless, the state has moved on its threat to withhold the salaries for school administrators who violate the mask enforcement prohibition. The governor, Ron DeSantis, has challenged the ruling, which will be kicked up to the First District Court of Appeals for further review. While battles play out in the courts of law and literal fights erupt at school board meetings over mask mandates, doctors in both states are warning that hospitals are quickly running out of intensive care unit beds, including pediatric beds meant for child patients. Texas Department of State Health Services data suggests there are only 74 pediatric intensive care unit beds open in the entire state. Even among regular intensive care unit beds, only a few hundred are left to serve a state with a population of 29 million. The situation in Florida is comparable. Data from the Hospital Utilization Dashboard from the Department of Health and Human Services suggests more than 93% of Florida's ICU intensive care unit beds are currently occupied, with nearly half being used to treat COVID-19 patients. Further complicating matters, several hospitals in Florida have reported they're running out of oxygen, which is key to treating COVID-19 patients who are struggling to breathe. Doctors in both states have expressed frustration and exhaustion over the latest surge in coronavirus patients, most of whom are unvaccinated. Governor Greg Abbott has failed us. A Republican state legislature has failed us, Dr. David Portugal, a cardiologist at Sugarland, Texas, told Houston Public Media. These leaders should be held accountable and be asked to explain how they can justify taking actions that are killing their fellow Texans. Despite the pleas from health professionals, Governor Greg Abbott and Governor Ron DeSantis have maintained their opposition to mask mandates. Ron DeSantis has claimed numerous times that masking is not an effective way to deter the coronavirus. And Greg Abbott has insisted that personal responsibility takes precedent over government mandates. Dr. Chad Sanborn, a pediatric infectious disease specialist at the Palm Beach Children's Hospital, disagreed with his governor's stance, saying that masking children was absolutely an effective mitigation tool for stopping coronavirus spread. face masks definitely decrease the spread among children, he told the Associated Press. They should be mandatory at schools. Childhood COVID-19 cases and deaths, while on the rise, still make up the smallest percentage of total deaths. Data from the American Academy of Pediatrics, drawn from 45 states, New York City, Puerto Rico, and Guam, showed that childhood deaths account for less than 1% of the overall mortality rate from COVID-19. Children are overall less susceptible to the worst symptoms of COVID-19. However, they can still act as disease vectors. As the Delta variant of the coronavirus has a significant higher transmissibility rate than previous variants, unmasked children packed into schools can still easily spread the virus around. While they may be resistant to symptoms, their parents and grandparents or other adults they come into contact with may be susceptible, especially if they are unvaccinated. The American Academy of Pediatrics has urged the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, to fast-track emergency approval, allowing children under the age of 12 to take the coronavirus vaccine due to the increasing rate of infection among children.
It's night, dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd.
Islamic laws.
Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. I know clouds are hidden behind these faces. Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats the enchanting whisper.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And our guest speaker, as always, Sheikh Javid. Salaam alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program again.
Salaam alaikum, rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Well, the concept and the topic that we are going to delve into related to the Islamic laws issued by Ayatollah Sistani is mourning. And that is the mourning for Imam Hussein and Muharram. And this is actually a good platform for me and the whole crew here from the RIB English Radio to express our condolences to everybody who's listening to us, to our dear audiences. And inshallah, we hope that this program would come to good use. Let's take a listen to a short biography of Ayatollah Sistani and then we'll be back.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of five, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzuma Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazvini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in fiqh and usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Shaykh Javid, we are talking about the laws, Islamic laws, according to Ayatollah Sistani, about mourning and lamentation for Imam Hussein to commemorate his martyrdom anniversary. And let me ask you this question. Is it permissible for a lady, a girl or a woman to recite elegies or requiem?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It depends on the situation and the setting, the place where the elegies are recited by a woman. Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that it is not permissible for a woman to recite elegies when it is likely mm-hmm. that men in the neighborhood might hear her. And it's of course not permissible for her to make her voice delicate, attractive, and pleasing, you know. Sometimes, a woman speaks and recites a poem in a simple way without even making her voice delicate, without her making her voice attractive. There's no problem. It's just like speaking to a woman, and a woman is speaking to you. There's no problem as long as there's no, lustful intention. But a woman cannot make her voice attractive, pleasing, mm-hmm. okay? Because it will make it haram if she does so. And if a woman knows that there are men outside hearing her voice, so it is haram for her to make her voice attractive, pleasing, and of course melodious. You can use the term, if I can use that word, you know. And if I'm wrong, you can correct me.
You know, so many people love Imam Hussein and their family members and His Eminence Abbas. So they rush to the Alam of Abbas, the flag of Abbas, this important legendary figure, the standard or flag bearer of Imam Hussein. And out of their love, they kiss the flag. Is it permissible to do this?
Well, first of all, there is no problem, there is no objection whatsoever to kissing the flag,
mm-hmm.
which is related to the flag of Abbas alayhi salatu wasalam, the standard bearer of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. You know, because it is related to the event of Ashura, so as long as it is related to that incident, to that epic, and to Abul Fazl al-Abbas alayhi salatu wasalam, there is no problem in kissing the flag, okay? Mm-hmm. But we should note that it's not a part of the religion. It is permissible per se, and there is nothing in the...
It's a culture, yeah, but not religious.
Yeah, it's not
necessarily
a religious, yeah, and not necessarily a religious issue.
Mm-hmm.
And you cannot find any text or any evidence or any textual proof in the religious sources to indicate that it's such a thing is either haram or highly recommended. Of course, in and of itself, kissing is permissible. Kissing is permissible because, just as I said, it is related to Imam Hussein, and whatever is related to Imam Hussein, to his family, and to the whole event of Karbala is respected, and mm-hmm. of course it's permissible to kiss it. But of course, one should not consider it as a part of the religion.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Something which is not a part of religion is not necessarily haram, okay? Mm-hmm. It could be permissible in and of itself. Permissible. Yes.
I see. Sheikh Javed, I have quite a relevant question, but let's take a break and we put it off to the part after the break. So stay with us. Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. We are talking about the laws according to Ayatollah Sistani about mourning and lamentation for Imam Hussein's martyrdom anniversary during Muharram. And Sheikh Javed, I asked you a question related to the love people have or the respect, so much high esteem that people have, Muslims have, for Imam Hussein and His Eminence Abbas. So they turn to their flags and alam and kiss that. And you answered that quite nicely before the break. But I have a question quite related to this. What about prostrating in front of or before alam or even the shrines of the infallible imams?
Well, that's also a very good question. Obviously, you know, we do know that sajda or prostration is, let's say, exclusively for God. Okay, mm-hmm. No one, nothing on earth deserves to be prostrated for in the world except Allah. So prostration is exclusively for Allah. And we cannot prostrate ourselves in front of anything, anything, including the shrines of the infallible imams, and the flags, okay, the flag of Abul Fazl al-Abbas, alayhi salatu wasalam, mm-hmm. or whatever deemed to be holy or sacred or sanctified, okay, it's not permissible. Because we should understand that based on the teachings of our religion, sajda is only for God. Sajda is only God has to be worshipped, and God is alone who deserves to be prostrated for. Okay,
yes.
And we should prostrate ourselves for God. Unfortunately, we see some people who do not have enough knowledge, who have who are ignorant, let's say,
mm-hmm.
Who have no proper understanding of religious teachings, of Islamic laws and legal rulings, going to the holy shrines of the imams. Let's say I have seen myself many people, for example, in Mashhad or in the holy city of Karbala in Najaf. They bend themselves, prostrate themselves.
And sometimes and no they one even... Is No one creep is, toward the shrine.
Yeah, of course they do. And no one actually objects to them. And no one tells them that this practice is not permissible, because it means you're actually somehow you are doing sajda for the imam, and imam and is not happy with that, with yes. this act, because sajda is exclusively for God.
Mm-hmm.
So if you come across such people, we should inform them that sajda is only for God, and no one else other than God deserves to be worshipped, deserves to be prostrated for. you know.
Yes, and I also heard, correct me if I'm wrong, you know, that in the shrines, well, there are some mosques, in fact, building around it, right?
Yes.
And in the times for prayer, it is, you know, not permissible. This is what I've heard. Please correct me. It is not permissible for a person to put the shrine in front of him while he's, like, saying the prayer and prostrating. I've heard that you have to find another spot in the mosque, inside the shrine, in fact, where the qibla is, like, right, there is no barrier, like the mosque, the shrine is not, like, in front of you and the qibla. It's something like that.
Well, it is not haram if the shrine is right in front of you, because,
yes,
for example, if you are if you go to a graveyard or a cemetery,
mm-hmm,
and there are graves all around you, you exactly can still pray inside the grave,
yes,
in the graveyard or at this cemetery,
mm-hmm,
despite all the graves being around you. It is makruh, okay?
Yes.
It is makruh to pray on a grave or in front, mm-hmm, of a grave, according to Ayatollah Sistani and according to many other religious authorities, as far as I know. So it's not haram to pray,
mm-hmm,
with the chamber of
the shrine.
Of the shrine being in front of you. Okay. But if it is deemed, in fact, if it is deemed, if it is considered by outsiders, by other people who are looking as a kind of, as an act of worshipping,
mm-hmm,
one should definitely avoid it. Because one should not,
so
create,
it's not permissible,
yeah,
then.
One should not create such an impression that he is worshipping, let's say, Imam Hussein, for example.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Once again, I use this opportunity to express our heartfelt condolences to our dear audiences, and may God accept all of our mourning and azadari for Imam Hussein and their pure household. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every breath that you did take, every step that you would make, purpose and guidance it gave, mankind's heart it reawaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Guide, you would be in place of Rasul to restore the sacred bridge. Light, you would radiate in the dark and continue the message. When you passed through arid sands, met foreigners of new lands.
www.parstoday.com/en